The hill that it has been climbing on Mars since the end of last year, it now has less than 210 feet to drive in order to reach the peak of the Husband Hill, as it's called, on the Red Planet, and should complete this climb this week. When the rover gets there, it will take photos of what should be a spectacular view, and Scout for Sites of Interest will post those pictures on the coasttocoastam.com website. This story is under Hot Stories on the website as well. Since 1976, NASA has captured satellite images of the surface of Mars, illustrating details of its rocky, irregular landscape. One NASA scientist joked that an image formation looked like a face. NASA quickly dismissed it as mere tricks of light and shadow. From that point forward, though, several experts and organizations have investigated the possibilities that these faces may actually have roots with ancient civilizations from Earth. In a moment, two guests, George Haas, William Sanders on Coast to Coast AM. George Haas is the founder and premier investigator of the Cydonia Institute, which was established in 1991. He is a member of the Pre-Columbian Society of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a sculptor, writer, curator, and member and former director of the Sculptors Association of New Jersey. He has also authored numerous monographs for various art exhibitions and had a one-person show at the O.K. Harris Gallery of Art in New York City's Soho. He became interested in the face on Mars after reading a book on the subject by Randolfo Rafael Pozos in 1991. He's one of our guests tonight on Coast to Coast, George Haas. Hi, George. How are you?
Hi, George. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you with us, too. William Sanders is a graduate of the University of Alberta in Edmonton. In 1977, with a Bachelor of Science degree in geomorphology, he began work in the petroleum industry in Calgary, Alberta in 1978. Currently works as an independent petroleum geoscientist consultant in Calgary. Mr. Sanders began looking at the Mars Global Surveyor images with their first release in April of 1998. He met Mr. Haas in a website conference room shortly afterwards. Hello, William. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Now, by the way, what is geomorphology?
It's a study of surface features, Earth's surface features.
Excellent. Now, while I was thumbing through your book, the Cydonia Codex, and looking at several forewords by, of course, Mark Carlotto, I came across another one, foreword of your book, by none other than Richard C. Hoagland of TheEnterpriseMission.com, so I thought it would be appropriate for Richard to do the forward live right here on Coast to Coast. Hi, Richard.
Good evening, George, or good morning, as the case may be.
You got that. Good to have you with us. And by the way,
good evening,
take
George
it away.
And William.
Good evening, Richard.
Hello, Richard.
What a surprise.
You know, it's kind of like a Mars sweep. Last night, Art did a show on Mars with Sir George Shultz.
It's a Mars party.
That's right, and he made some very gracious mentions of my work. And you know, George, number one, it is really cool to watch this unfold, because when I did monuments so many years ago, I was basically by myself. I mean, there was Vince and there was, you know, other folks, but, you know, it was basically just me, myself, and I.
Mm-hmm.
And in the ensuing years, there have been a number of people, students who have read monuments, read the book that I did with Randy Pozos, and have taken our words to heart. David Flynn is one. There's a guy I'm going to introduce you in the audience to in the next few weeks who's in South Africa, who's doing some astonishing work that's going to absolutely blow your socks off, so you're going to have to go out and buy new socks. And tonight, I am so looking forward to this interview, because when George Haas first contacted me and laid out his ideas, which I'm not going to give away so you can, you know, have this whole neat thing to yourself, I was dumbfounded, because he had found independently here on Earth examples of precisely what I had stood before the UN in 1992 and said existed at Cydonia on Mars, namely a bifurcated dual artistic image, the hominid feline fusion in the face on Mars. And what George and William have done is to find stunning examples on this planet of cultures that we all know about, that we all learned about in school, who have taken this same artistic tack. And he and William have done a stunning job of laying out all these examples. They went to my publisher, who turned them down until I basically made a phone call and said, you got to take a look at their work again. And their book is really cool, and I look forward to spending an evening working here in front of the computer and listening to some very good friends talk about some very important stuff.
Well, Richard, I love the written forward, but I absolutely adore the live forward. So thanks so much. We'll be in touch, my friend.
Take it away, George.
All right, Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, and our guests, of course, George Haas and William Sanders. George and William, we'll just, for the next couple hours, we'll just chit-chat about your book and your theories, and then later on, the last hour, we'll open up the phone lines to allow our coast-to-coast listeners an opportunity, a great opportunity, I should say, to chat with both of you as well about this. George, let's go with you first. Give me a little bit more of your background beyond what I have already read.
Basically, I'm an artist. I started out as a painter. I exhibited in a lot of galleries in New Jersey and New York throughout the 70s and 80s. And slowly my work progressed into sculpture. I started curating exhibitions and writing catalogs. And that's where I had the idea to do writing. And currently I'm part of the New Jersey Sculptors Association. And my other interests are, of course, Mars and ancient cultures on Earth.
Okay. William Saunders, take it away.
Well, I started in oil and gas exploration in 1978 here in Calgary, and I worked in an office for about 10 years, and then I decided that field work was more to my liking, so I began to do field consulting work, which is what I do right now. When they drill for oil and gas, I'm on location.
And tell me how you two truly meshed together during this website conference.
Well, it was on Richard's, Richard Hoagland.
Richard Hoagland again.
He's everywhere, this guy.
Well, this was the old board, the old Enterprise Mission board.
Okay.
That recently, you know, shut down.
Right. He had a conference center there where people would discuss the new Mars Global Surveyor images. And there was one particular forum called Sidonia in April, and both George and I had been contributing comments to it. And some discoveries that I had made, I was looking for some response from some of the other contributors, and nobody seemed to be responding. And then finally, George responded, and things sort of went from there. We were both interested in what each other was doing and started to collaborate, and it just took off.
What was it like for both of you, you first, George, when you first saw the Cydonia face?
The 1998 image?
Yes.
I was very excited just to see the detail, and a lot of researchers at the time were kind of discouraged. They thought that it was not the same mesa that originally had been photographed in 1976.
Right.
What really struck me at the beginning was the what a lot of other people thought was this Egyptian-type headdress, and at the center of that headdress was this tri-leaf symbol, which that's what really struck us. And started a lot of the research into the Mesoamerican culture.
And, you know, in the 1976 picture, too, what really caught my eye, literally, was the possibility of the eyeballs being in this structure, too. To me, it looked like, and I looked at some of the pictures, it looked like, indeed, eyeballs were made within the sockets. And that I found to be fascinating.
Right. Well, the eyeball was actually verified in the in 2001 with the which I call the M16 image, which was the Mars Global Surveyor image M16-00184, which was a high resolution image of partial side of the humanoid side of the face, and that captured the beautiful image of the eye. You could see the pupil, the iris, all of the lid creases. It was amazing.
If the structures on Mars are indeed made by artificial intelligence, and then they bear an incredible resemblance to some of the structures on this planet, one has got to make some pretty fascinating assumptions that what was built on Mars and who built them might have done the same thing here. Would you both agree with that?
I would say yes. It would be extremely likely that well, from what George and I have found, that whoever built these structures on Mars had an intimate knowledge of Earth Earth's animals, Earth's humans, mythology and religious mythologies. And so that's what we found. We found the art and sculpture of Earth's religious mythologies constructed in these what we call geoglyphs on the surface of Mars. So whoever built them definitely had a connection to this planet.
And we're definitely going to talk about that connection tonight. Cydonia Institute, what is that?
The Cydonia Institute was started back in 1991. I became so convinced after reading the book, The Face on Mars, Evidence of a Lost Civilization by Puzos, that I got together a group of concerned researchers that I had known, George Dutton and Lee Bogart, and early member Pam Feather, who's no longer with us. And we just got as much information about Mars and the available data that we could. And as a group, we made the first discovery about the idea that the Mesoamerican culture was producing these two-faced masks that was very similar to the face on Mars, and that's what prompted my phone call to Richard Hoagland.
Do you find that there's a lot of interest still in the structures on Mars?
By the public?
By anybody out there.
It appears from our standpoint that only fellow researchers seem to be very interested in this. The public at this point, hopefully our book will change this, are unaware of any of this. And so there really isn't much of a marker to judge their interest.
Yeah. You mean the generation? Because, you know, during Hoagland's period, when Monuments of Mars was out, you know, there was a widespread interest. And then, you know, as things move on, as new generations come on, I think, you know, younger America probably isn't aware or really understands, I think, the depth and scope of what could be on that planet.
Well, I think a lot of the problem had to do with NASA being so successful in dictating to the public what they should expect when looking at the face on Mars.
I want you to tell me a little bit about, first of all, the name of the book. You know, we had just done a complete show a month or so ago about Codex, which, you know, believe it or not, in Europe, they're passing to do away with the supplemental vitamins and things like that. This is called the Cydonia Codex. Tell me why. Who wants that?
Bill?
Go ahead, George.
Well, we use the word codex as a wordplay because of the Mesoamerican connection,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure most of the listening audience know that the Aztec are famous for their accordion folding type books that are called the codex. And through our research, we're thinking that a lot of these geoglyphs that are in the Cydonia area and beyond Cydonia are all part of this matrix around the planet of this language and these geoglyphic pictographs that are somehow connected to the whole mythology that the Maya had of this ancient book that no one could see was called the Popol Vuh, which was the original book of creation that the gods wrote. And it was written at the beginning of time, and it was you were unable to see the book, and the book was hidden from the searcher and the thinker.
And tell me more about the Mayan connection with all this. George?
Yes. Well, like Richard had stated, we originally noticed this two-faced bifurcated connection with the Mesoamerican art.
Mm-hmm.
And when looking at the face on Mars, we noticed that, like I said earlier, the tri-leafed symbol, which was on the forehead of the humanoid side of the face when it's mirrored. You see the
right.
Symmetrical aspect of the tri-leaf symbol. And after we performed some research and we had looked into this emblem, we found that it was a prominent symbol of royalty in the early Olmec culture and the Mayan culture. And the flanged headdress that was around the original 1998 image of the face on Mars, also the Olmec produced these flanged headdresses, similar to like Tutankhamun's type of the formal Egyptian type headdress. So we now had two markers for Mesoamerican culture. And then we looked at the facial features and all the ornamentation around the nose. There was a lot of debate early on about the absence of a nasal feature, But for our research, we believe the nose is obscured by a nose ornament, a highly elaborate type of ornament. And also in the mouth area of the 1998 image of the humanoid side, there's a prominent tooth in the center. And that tooth has like a round circular dot on it, which again is another iconographic symbol of Mesoamerica. A lot of the lords wore these ornamental gemstones on their tooth made of obsidian and things like that.
You've sent us 6 images that we have posted on the coasttocoastam.com website. Some of them are startling, quite frankly. Let's talk a little bit about the cover of the book of Cydonia Codex. The two pictures we see, not the graphic pictures now, but the two pictures that we see, what are they? How about you, Bill?
Are you referring to the Mars pictures or the drawings?
Not the drawings, but the ones I see. The
I believe you're talking about the Viking image, Bill.
Yeah, like we call it the Viking image.
Yeah. It's on the cover of your book.
Pardon me?
The two black and white pictures on the cover of your book.
Right. The one that George mentioned is the Viking. That's kind of a nickname we gave it. That's in plate 5 for anybody who's got access to your website.
All right.
What you're seeing on the cover is a mirrored image. It's a half face that we did a flip to give it a full face presentation. You can see on the plate 5 the half face, and we indicate where we drew the demarcation line and did the flip. We believe that this is actually a replica of the Aztec Mayan god Quetzalcoatl. We have the picture that's beside this Mars image on the cover is a profile image of that Mayan god, Aztec god.
Why would these pictures be halves on the planet?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know for sure. We have theories. There could be a number of reasons. The Maya had a strong belief in the duality of all things, life, death, man, woman, that sort of thing, night, day. And since pretty well all the images that we've found so far have Mesoamerican connection, we feel that this is a possible reason, that it's indicating duality. It could also be that... if you believe the ancient texts, Sumerian texts, that we are actually a hybrid of earth creatures and an alien race. And perhaps the people who built this are trying to tell us that. But, you know, we have different theories, but we're not certain.
My initial exposure to Cydonia, of course, was when I saw a video of Richard C. Hoagland years ago on a cable channel, and then, of course, listening to him chat with Art Bell on Coast to Coast. And then, of course, I would interview on my own Vince DiPietro about his research into the face. And I was amazed at the similarities that different people were bringing to this theory and now bringing yours too. It seems like, you know, there's something there. You know the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. In this particular case, there could very well be something to these photographs. With our guests George Haas and William Sanders, George, in your opinion, first and foremost, what do you think the face on Mars in that Cydonia region is?
I believe it's a two-faced geoglyph. It's basically like a hieroglyphic... writing system that we're finding throughout the Cydonia area.
Trying to send us a message back here, or do you think they were just building a wonderful structure for their own planet?
I think there was a purpose behind the building of these structures. The face is not the only bifurcated structure
right
in Cydonia, although that's got most of the attention from the public. The Cydonia area is basically littered with these type of things. And there's also half-faced images, like the Viking that we were discussing in Plate 5.
Yes.
And if we could go back to Plate 5 for just a minute, We didn't get a chance really to discuss the features of that face.
I am there.
And what we've done in the book is compare that facial structure, which is actually just a half of a face, as Bill had mentioned. And the Olmec and the Maya also produced these not only bifurcated two-faced masks, they also produced half-faced masks. Now, these masks weren't profiles. They were partial faces, just split right down the middle. And this was a technique called cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
A similar structure was found right here on Earth. A huge, gigantic half-faced geoglyph was discovered back in 2001 in Caral, Peru, that dated to before 2500 B.C.
Now, this mirrored flip, is it exactly the way it is with the two pieces flipped back to back, or have you enhanced it a little bit?
We don't enhance any of the images in the book.
Okay.
We use all of the images from JPL, which were free to use, and basically we're using NASA's own images to show this.
We do adjust the contrast.
Okay. Well, it isn't. I'll tell you what, plate 5, when you look at the mirrored flip, looks very, very strange. I mean, this looks like a bearded figure to me, of a face. You can clearly see the eyes. You can clearly see the nose. And
he has a chin guard and those braids going down the side. Those are that's actually a serpent.
Yes. Now, what is that around his head? Is that like a halo or an aura? What do you think that is?
Bill believes that this depicts Quetzalcoatl emerging out of water. There's like the. It looks very much like there's his face is coming out of the water.
I hate to say this, too, only because of the similarities, but, I mean, this face looks a little bit like the biblical pictures I've seen of Jesus. It looks almost like the Shroud of Turin a little bit, doesn't it?
A lot of people have compared it to that.
Which is pretty strange all by itself.
Well, it just shows the power of these type of images, which a lot of people bring their own personal, you know, feelings and past experiences into these. We try to look at these point by point and just follow the data, and we notice that there's just all this symbolism in these images.
Okay, you know how sometimes you can look at some clouds and you can make out what you think is, oh, there's a puppy, or here's something that looks like a bird, or you look at the bark of a tree and you can say, look, that looks almost like a face. Is that what we're looking at here, or is it something really more thought out?
Can I comment on
absolutely
that?
Jump sure. In anytime, you two.
What we have found here is a consistent symbolism. It's redundant, it's repeated over and over again, not just in the fact that we can we have about over 24 images here that we compare to Mesoamerican art and sculpture. So that right there says that statistically it's impossible for one to just be seeing abstract things and making something out of them, because we found these images on Mars fairly quickly over the first year of our research. The Mayan or the Mesoamerican connections to them we found over time after that. We didn't go looking for, you know, let's match this and let's match that. It just, it was there.
How big would this structure on plate 5 be in terms of...
The actual head itself from the chin to the top of the helmet is about 3/4 mile.
Okay, so it's absolutely huge. In terms of structures, I don't think we have anything on this planet quite that size, do we? Man-made?
Well, some of the Nazca lines could be. I'm not exactly sure how big they are, but some of those Nazca line images are quite large.
Are these things, though, carved out of stone? Is that what we're looking at here?
Well, some of them are somewhat carved, and some of them are more like mosaics, where they're just pieces of rocks put in certain positions
on flat land.
So that when you're looking at them from orbit or from above,
yes,
it makes an image. When you get too close, it disappears, just like you're looking at a mosaic. I would say that this particular one in plate 5, if you're looking at the half face there on the left, it looks like it's been carved out of the side of the rock because there's no disturbance above it, no disturbance beside it on either side. So it and the, all the different geometric shapes, it definitely looks like it was carved.
Were you shocked when you put this into a mirrored flip?
Yes, well, I could say that, you know, after a period of time, the shock value kind of wore off because from the very beginning it was kind of one shock after another.
It's like a code.
You get a little numb after a while.
Right, and we should point out that this Viking image was found around the main city pyramid.
Yes.
In the Sidonia area. And this the apron of this pyramid has these half pictographs all the way around. So this was just one of the pictographs that was found on the apron area of the main pyramid at Sidonia.
How close?
And the other interesting thing is that each of these pictographs are intimately related with the other through Mesoamerican mythologies.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
Bill?
The connection between the images?
The
around the apron of the main pyramid where the Viking is, and then we have the water lily jaguar, and then we have the image of the admiral.
Because they've all got to be related somehow, right?
Yes. Well, we found that these images seem to be depicting the Maya creation myths, and there's a constant theme of death and resurrection. And it's some of it may be a bit suggestive that we have pointed out in our book, but some of it is very, very plain and very easy to see. That message of death and resurrection seems to be repeated over and over again. The images around the main pyramid are connected to the Maya gods, which we think are all basically different aspects of one person or one being.
Do you think the Mayans might have been descendants of Martians?
No.
You do not?
No, and this is one problem we've initially encountered, is that people think that we're saying that the Maya were from Mars or the Maya went to Mars and built these. That isn't the case at all. It's Earth has a, well, let's say the Maya believe that we're in the fifth sun, the fifth age of man, and so do the Buddhists also believe we're in the fifth age of man. And we've been finding here in Sidonia overlapping symbolism between Mesoamerica, Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Asia, and especially Buddhist and Hindu mythology. But the idea that they were created by the Maya is not true. I think that there was a civilization, a high civilization on Earth, that disappeared, and the Maya had the remnants of it and built their religious mythology about that.
So what are we dealing with, though? Two separate incidents of civilizations, one on Mars, what we had here on Earth at the time? I mean, it's too coincidental, a word that I don't believe in, that we would have similar things on two planets so close together.
Right. Well, we get into a lot of speculation at this point.
Oh, sure.
in trying to figure out what happened. However, independent research done by Zachariah Sitchin, he discusses the idea that the Anunnaki brought the black-headed people down to South America and instigated the Olmec and the Maya civilizations. So possibly that could be how they had this whole matrix of all this similar iconography with the bifurcated mask and things like that. And then also there's the problem with Marduk, whose father was Ea,
mm-hmm.
and according to Sitchin's interpretations of these sacred scrolls and tablets of Mesoamerica or Mesopotamia with the Sumerians, he was exiled on Mars, and he possibly could have constructed these images up there, which is basically a whole matrix of creation mythologies.
Well, I got to tell you, Plate 5 is dramatic. Plate 4 is downright spooky when you look at that, because, you know, when you remember the movie Gremlins?
Yes.
I mean, that little creature looks like one of those gremlins on his back.
Well, this whole image was discovered by Bill, and this was all connected to Richard Hoagland had speculated that you could view the face on Mars would go directly to the city square of the Sidonia complex. And we had found in the center of the city complex a bat, a pictograph of a bat.
Okay.
When that's mirrored in the center, it forms a bat. The bat is an image of inversion.
Yes.
It's a symbol of inversion. You know, bats hang upside down.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So Bill got the idea of inverting the face on Mars and seeing what we would find.
Okay. So if I just turn around, there we are. It does. It looks like a strange little creature, doesn't it? What
are
is
you talking
that?
About the...
plate number four.
Right. You're talking about the dog at the top?
No, not the dog at the top. What's the creature right at the in the middle, right underneath the bluish tinge?
Oh, okay.
It looks like two paws and two feet are sticking up looking at us, and then it's got his face with these strange ears.
Oh, he's looking at the Horus, the sun.
If you look on the right, we have the Egyptian glyphs that match the Mars image, and at the very top is the dog, Sirius, representing Sirius.
Right. Dog star. And then right under him, what's that?
The blue is the vault of the sky.
Right.
It's a depression, and we've colored it in blue. And then right below that in brown is a Horus, the sacred falcon. It's a spread-winged falcon, and it's got two serpents on either side.
This is the lip area of the face on Mars if you're looking at it normally.
Upside down, that's right. But see, what I look at when I'm looking at this, I wish everybody had a computer right now so they could go and look at plate four on our website that you sent us. To me, it looks like a creature or an animal with what you've called Horus. To me, looks like its face. And then on the raw portion, it looks like two paws. And then on the bottom, the ka looks like two of its feet. I mean, it looks like an animal on its back looking up at us.
Well, I see how you're
see
seeing
that?
It as something that's like hunched over with its feet out.
Yes.
Going to jump at you.
Yes.
Right. Well, this same idea is done in Mesoamerican art. You have this contour rivalry where they have faces hidden in faces and faces make up figures. It's composite imagery. And this is the same idea that you're seeing, this whole composite type idea.
It is really.
I see what you're seeing now.
It pops right out
flesh,
when you look at it.
Right, the flesh-toned area, that's the famous teardrop image or teardrop feature that's on the face on Mars, below the eye.
Yes.
And that figure there's got her arms up, and she's her hands are turned up, and that's the teardrop.
Well, you know, regardless of what these are, George and William, it's pretty difficult to assume these are natural structures.
Oh, they're very complex.
Yes. So let's talk about, now this is, of course, pure speculation. How old do you think these structures are? Go with you, William.
That is tough. George and I have tossed this around for, well, since 1998. But the fact that what we have found seems to cover a spectrum of ages in the Earth mythology that we're not really sure when they were built. I guess for sure they were built before 1976.
And the other problem is, Bill, we found that some of these are in like pristine condition and others seem to be eroded.
Really?
Yes. Well, if you're looking at that plate four again,
yeah,
the flesh-colored, those are actually the hands of Isis, and you can actually see the individual fingers, and those are sticking up in the air. So if there was any erosion, they would have been gone. And there's a number of things that we have found that has very intricate pieces to it.
Why aren't we sending rovers to areas like this, which to me would show mounds more information?
Well, the Viking lander was actually the original 1976 Viking lander was supposed to land in Cydonia, but they determined that the ground was too uneven and it was too risky.
There was too many ruins there to land.
Yeah. Maybe they're afraid what we'd see.
Well, I think you answered your own question.
That could be. Because I'm telling you, these pictures are just remarkable. Let's move up. Well, we have a few minutes here to plate three, if we can, comparison of the mirrored feline side of the face on Mars. What's that? Plate three.
You want to take that, George?
Plate two and three are actually the left and the right side of the 1998 face on Mars, which is the humanoid side in plate two, and plate three has the Jaguar side. In doing our research, we found that we were doing these comparisons, and actually those drawings that these mirrored images are being compared to are done by Linda Schilly, and those are from a temple at Cerros, Mexico.
I can see why Richard C. Hoagland is so obsessed with these things. I mean, once you start looking at them, you can't stop looking.
Right.
Do you ever get any NASA people pull you aside and say, well, let me tell you what I think these are? Does that ever happen?
No, we haven't had the opportunity.
Not yet. They're out there somewhere.
But we feel that we've made a direct correlation here between these two these corresponding masks found at this temple in Cerros with the face on Mars. Now, in plate three, that is a Jaguar mask, which represents the sun.
Okay. Do you, in the book, address the pyramids that are on Mars at all? Do you get into that?
No, we basically are left to discuss all the geoglyphic structures in the area.
All right.
We don't even touch the D&M pyramid.
Okay, stay with us. Much more to come, because I want to get your thoughts now on exactly who you think built these and what the tie-in with planet Earth might be. And then later on, we'll open up the phone lines for you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with George Haas and William Saunders. We're talking about their book, The Cydonia Codex. George and William, I assume because you co-authored the book together, your views are the same, or were you at odds about some of your theories here?
I just say that for the first little while, it's a good thing we were 2,000 miles apart. George is in New Jersey, and I'm in Alberta, Canada.
You couldn't go toe to toe, huh?
No, we had a lot of disagreements to begin with, but we've eventually what we found sort of brought us together.
Let's talk about these ancient civilizations and the possibility that this is a type of ancient art. Is it more of ancient art, or do you think there's a message behind their art? Were they trying to tell the universe something? We'll go with you first, William.
Well, I think it is. Well, it's definitely art. Can I just go back to that plate four for a second, and I'll kind of work it into this conversation.
Oh, darn, George, I just closed it. All right, I'll get back to it. Okay, go ahead.
Richard Hoagland had said in his book, The Monuments of Mars, that he was making a connection with ancient Egypt, and he said Heru can equally apply to the sun on the horizon, a race between gods and men, a face on the horizon, and the king as a representative of the sun god. Well, at plate four, we're saying it's the depiction of the helical rising of Sirius, and the top image is Sirius, the dog star. Below that is the vault of the sky.
Right.
And below that is Horus. Now, Horus, as Richard Hoagland said, can mean face on the horizon, etc. Horus was the sacred falcon, and he was the god of the rising and setting sun. And he lifted the sun, or Ra, the sun god, above the horizon. So what you're seeing is Sirius has just risen above the vault in the sky. Immediately below in the brown is Horus, the sacred falcon, lifting Ra, the sun god, which is just below him, above the horizon. And below that is Isis with her hands raised in praise. And right beside it, you can see those Egyptian hieroglyphs depicting that same thing.
So what we're showing you, George, here is that these aren't arbitrary symbols. This is all intimately related. And not only that, when we showed you in plate two and three, with the humanoid side and the jaguar side, which related to the temple at Cerros, Mexico.
Yes.
Linda Schilly goes on in her book discussing the temple, and the whole meaning of that temple is also the rising of Horus. So this is just repeated over and over and over and over again.
Now the Egyptians,
unfrickin' believable.
the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Romans, they all had gods. The gods, they referred to the gods all the time. Well, for some reason, over time, we disregarded that as nonsense. That there was no such thing as gods, and they were just figments of their imagination. Well, according to the ancient texts that have been found, the cuneiform tablets from Sumeria and some of the other Mesopotamian cultures, the gods were real, and they were extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm.
And they ruled Earth and Earth city-states till about 3000 BC, when they allowed mankind to take over ruling. So if you believe that, then it makes sense that, and also that they had a way station on Mars. So if you believe that, it makes perfect sense why we're finding depictions of Earth's cultures and mythologies on Mars, because the gods traveled between Earth and Mars.
You know, Richard Hoagland believes that we are the Martians, maybe a little different from your thoughts, but that perhaps these were left behind as messages whenever we went back, just to kind of prove to us
right, well,
who
that
we
goes,
might have been.
That goes back to the idea where Marduk being exiled to Mars with the Igi, that he had produced all of these structures as a blasphemous act against his father because he didn't inherit the throne or the kingdom. His brother did, who was actually Quetzalcoatl.
How would they have made these structures? Any idea?
We'll have to go there to find out.
Huge lasers? Labor? What do you think?
Well, it could be a combination of both. I mean, they probably had the technology, and you got to remember too, the gravity on Mars is a lot less, so it would be possible to build larger structures, you know, more easily. But they would have had the technology, probably, you know, laser technology, possibly, you know, anti-gravity. Who knows? But certainly, they would have had the technology if they could fly back and forth.
Well, there's no doubt about that. The structures that we find Mars, so close to planet Earth in terms of, you know, miles within this universe, I would assume that we might have other structures like this on other planets. If not in the solar system, definitely within this universe. Do you subscribe to that, you George?
I haven't seen any evidence of it yet, but I have seen pictures of possible step-type pyramidal structures on our closest body, the moon, but most of the evidence that we're finding is right in NASA photographs of Mars.
How about you, William?
Well, I think that Richard Hoagland has showed some pictures from the moon that definitely indicate that there's something unusual up there in the terms of structures, maybe not geoglyphic structures like we're seeing here, but you never know. And certainly, there's other bodies in the solar system, some of Saturn's moons, Jupiter's moons, that, you know, could possibly be capable of sustaining. I think one of the reasons why we're finding these on Mars is because of the fact that there's no erosion or very little erosion. So these are going to last for a long time.
Maurice Cotterell, researcher, has mirrored images from the Incas and the Mayans, and they are remarkably similar to some of the things you've imaged on Mars. His images, of course, are earthbound. Yours are Martian-bound. Yet there are a lot of similarities here. That's the one thing I can't seem to get over, the distance, the great distance, but the similarities that are there. It's almost to me as if one group did both things.
Well, we did a lot of research with Cotterell's Lid of Pakal.
Yes.
We actually devote one of the chapters to doing parallel comparisons to images we're finding on Mars that mimic the mirrored images that he's finding within the lid. We have a Maya bat god that we found on Mars that practically matches the Mayan bat god that he found on the lid, the jaguar god. They're practically twins when you compare them in the book. And one image that he didn't even realize that he had discovered, the cosmic monster, which was below the jaguar god on the lid of Bacal. And in the book, we compare that cosmic monster motif with a Mesoamerican sculpture, which is, again, almost an exact match. So, and we've tried to contact Maurice Cotterell, but we haven't heard anything from his publisher because we think he'd be very interested in looking at some of this stuff.
Oh, we can get to him for you if you need that. Just, you know, get back to Lisa, and she can send anything over to him.
That would be great.
If that would help you. Sure, absolutely. Well, for both of you, what did you find to be, in your research, one of the most dramatic, maybe startling things that you uncovered as you were doing this work?
For me, it was, well, we devote Chapter 10 to it. It's called The Mountain of Life, Death, and Resurrection. And I don't really want to give too much away. I want the readers to read it for themselves, but there's some pretty startling images there. And this this mountain is actually described by a German, I guess he was a
theologian, and he was a historian.
Historian, yes. And he dealt with cosmology and the nature of the universe and philosophy and that sort of thing. And he states, this. I'm quoting this from the Dictionary of Symbols, by J.E. Serlow. He quotes Marius Schneider quite a bit. And Schneider wrote this back in the 1930s or 40s. The mountain of Mars, or Janus, which rises up as the mandorla of Gemini, is the locale of inversion, the mountain of death and resurrection. The mandorla is another sign of inversion and of interlinking, for it is formed by the intersection of the circle of the earth with the circle of heaven. This mountain has two peaks, and every symbol or sign alluding to this situation of inversion is marked by duality or by twin heads.
And isn't that what we're finding on Mars?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We found that quote to be stunning. We mention it a few times in the book.
Do you, because a lot of ancient religions that have now become our beliefs today have been so prevalent, do you see some messages there beyond some of the things, of course, that we've talked about already? Messages of universal things that I guess people would be so perplexed with if they uncovered it.
Well, like Bill had said earlier, we're just finding this repetitive life, death, and resurrection type of message in all of this work. With when we're finding these bifurcated two-faced structures, not only is the geoglyph split in half and you have a face on each side, each image is intimately related to its companion face through Mesoamerican mythology, their gods, and also we can find parallels with some of the other cultures because there's this whole parallel between these gods that we're finding.
Can you imagine what astronauts would do when they get to these structures? And one day they will. I mean, they will, maybe within 10, 20 years. And they walk up to them. Assuming you're correct, what will they see at Mars level? Would they be able to make out anything, or do you have to see it simply from above?
Yeah, well, basically, what we have in our book is images that you need to see from above. I think that they'll definitely be able to see the artificial nature of their structure. But there are other images here that are profiles, and some of the so-called craters are not actually real craters. They seem to be specifically designed. And so, well, it's hard to say, but it's going to be very interesting for them, that's for sure.
See, I think that Mars, perhaps more than Earth at one time, might have been the gem of the solar system. And then, of course, the calamity occurred.
It's possible that this theme of death and resurrection may be referring to the planet Mars, that it was alive and it died, but it's capable of being resurrected.
And then the resurrection could have been here?
Or maybe it's saying that we can resurrect Mars. We can turn it back into a living planet.
Terraform it again, maybe? That's very possible. Possible indeed. What has been the reaction to your book from people? George?
Bill and I have done two conventions already. We did the X conference, and we got a very warm response. A lot of people, we were surprised, never even heard of the original Faith on Mars, and so we got a lot of good responses.
The book has just been out for about a month and a half, so we haven't. We did have it out on CD-ROM earlier, but not too many people were interested in reading a 500-page book on their computer. So.
Why do you think this Cydonia region has been so labeled with structures and things? Why that region on the planet?
Phil?
I think Richard Hoagland would probably be a better person to ask that question, because he has done a lot of research into the symbolism of the the latitudes and different alignments of structures. But George and I have found other areas of Mars that also have similar geoglyphs, half bifurcated geoglyphs and profiles, and you've probably heard from and seen other researchers, anomaly hunters, that have found profiled faces in different parts of Mars. So I think that Cydonia is just one area, but certainly it's the largest that we've found so far.
Okay, I may do that too. I may have Richard join us this last half hour with you. We'll take phone calls next hour and get some of his theories with what you're saying. There's no question, reading his book, reading yours, reading Vince DiPietro's, reading others, there's some tie-ins here. You all look at it with different perspectives, but you're all coming at it the same way. Something happened a long time ago. I think Vince DiPietro once told me he thinks that face on Mars structure is about a billion years old. If that's the case, that thing's held up pretty well, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing we can find out when we actually go there, because, you know, we've been waiting for a lot of these Themis images and trying to find out what type of materials are made, you know, what these actual maces, you know, which NASA likes to call them, what they're actually made of. Are they metals? Are they just rock? You know, at this point, we have no idea.
Well, we just sent the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter there. It'll get there next year. Maybe we'll get some better pictures. What do you think?
It's possible. Can I just say, George, a lot of researchers who think that these are very old structures are looking at them as former structures that are eroded away. And George and I have found that that's not the case at all, that these are intentionally designed as is. And they're in basically pristine condition. There's probably deposition of Martian sand and silt, making them a little fuzzy, but there really doesn't seem to be much sign of erosion. They're hidden.
Where do you get the book, by the way, the Cydonia Codex? Where do you find it, George?
The book's available at, of course, our publisher, NorthAtlanticBooks.com, or you can order it through the Cydonia Institute at P.O. Box 1032, Jackson, New Jersey, zip code 08527. It's also available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and I guess it can be ordered at any local bookstore. And Bill also has the Cydonia Institute P.O. Box up in Canada.
And what is that, Bill?
Oh, of course you asked me. I don't have it handy.
Okay, we can get it off your website?
Yeah, it's on our website on the book page.
Okay, and I'll have you mention a little bit more about where the book is available. Our listeners, once they hear guests that they like and enjoy, just love to get your material. So, you know, this is good material. It's good research, and by all means, I want everybody to have an opportunity to look at your theories in this area. And you've done a great job with the pictures and picking them out as well. So when we come back, we'll have George Haas and William Saunders and also Richard C. Hoagland have Richard tie some of this together with his theories on Cydonia, because he's the master of that region, almost like the map maker, isn't he? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And with our guest George Haas, William Saunders, and he's back, Richard C. Hoagland, because we'll talk a little bit about the monuments of Mars. And welcome back to Coast with our two guests, of course, George Haas and William Saunders, and joined by Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, your views are not too much different than the views of George here and William, are they?
Well, yes and no. You know, what's interesting is to hear independent researchers looking at the same data set and coming to similar conclusions, but some are different in detail. And, you know, I've often said on this show and many others that science is nothing if it's not prediction. When I wrote Monuments, and it's now in its, fifth edition, I guess, you know, many, many years ago, first edition came out in 1987.
That's when I saw you on cable, by the way.
On CNN or, I said some things in Monuments. For instance, there's a chapter I devote to the search for a terrestrial connection, because to my mind, it was inconceivable that we could have a humanoid face and we could have, you know, the history of evolutionary biology on Earth is given to us by science, people like Gaylord Simpson at Harvard, and that you could have an independent reinvention of a humanoid species right next door, the thing you were grappling with over the last hour. And so I made a rather bold prediction that there had to be some deep, intrinsic, fundamental connection between what happened on Mars, if it was real, and what's happened on Earth in terms of the iconography, the monuments, the rituals, the ceremonies, the history, the myths, the legends, all of that, that somehow these two places had to be connected if the face on Mars, the monuments of Mars, are real. We now fast forward the film to, you know, mid-2005, which is how many years after 1987? Somebody please do that for me.
18 years. Yes.
We've got two guys, George and Bill, who have done their homework. You're listening to two scholars in separate but related fields that elegantly come together in these studies. And what they've done is put meat on the bones to my, you know, out on a limb predictions. They have found the terrestrial connection, and they have found it in space. I hope everybody listening tonight gets how phenomenal this program is, because we are now light years beyond NASA's stupid, it's just a trick of light and shadow.
No, they could simply, they might be just saying that, though, Richard.
Well, of course they're saying that. We know that. The evidence, the proof. I mean, the night that George announced to me that they were going to be doing a book was the night that I had Kinsea join me on the show with Art. This was after the 2001 mail-in full frontal image had been taken after much controversy in the spring of 2001, where we finally had a crystal clear, you know, modern technology Mars Surveyor full face-on image at highest resolution, 1.4 meters per pixel. And there is no doubt that this thing is a face to any objective viewer.
Well, I'm going to play a moment here as if I have seen you at a conference speak, which I do so often, and you're so eloquent. I'm going to sit back in the audience, Mr. Hoagland, and I'm going to watch you as the panel director chat with George and William about this, and I'm just going to sit back in awe and have you entertain me and have you give us information on Cydonia.
So you're so kind.
Take it away.
George. All right.
You're going to replace Art Bell?
Say again?
I guess you're going to be replacing Art Bell.
I guess I'm replacing Art, yeah. George, as
nobody will replace Art Bell.
As an artist, as someone who has a history in the study of art, you know, you've got degrees, you've done a lot of your homework, how would you view what you found on Mars in terms of traditional art history, in terms of why people do things, how they express themselves, the kinds of messages that art, if it's done by humans, is supposed to communicate? In other words, compare what you found on Mars to traditional art examples on Earth.
Well, the structures on Mars are very traditional.
Now, don't you find that remarkable?
Right. When you compare them to known terrestrial cultures, we're showing that the face on Mars is a legitimate two-faced work of art. Not only that, it's a geoglyphic structure that's possibly part of a entire global writing system that we're finding on Mars. And it's just amazing.
Okay, when you say global writing system, can you get into that a little better? What do you mean by writing system? I mean, we're not seeing letters here.
Right, well, we're viewing these geoglyphs as more than just artwork, that they're probably part of some type of language. Some of the other structures that we're finding not only have the bifurcated face motif, but there's also other elements and more symbolism and decorative elements that could be related to a type of a writing system.
Now, we have parallels here for that?
If you compare the Mesoamerican writing system to some of these geoglyphs that we're finding on Mars, the parallel is overwhelming.
Have you possibly found anything similar to the Mayan numbering system in these glyphs? Or have you looked?
Well, just below the face, we found another bifurcated geoglyph with what we believe represents a rabbit on one side and looks like a simian-type face on the other. And in the rabbit headdress, there appears to be like bar and dot-type numbering system.
Which is the classic Mayan way of writing.
Right, which
numbers.
Relates to 18 rabbits. In the Maya culture, the Lord 18 Rabbit would have on his forehead, he would have two bars, which would be the Maya writing system with the dots numbering 18. Now, we identified that half of the structure as 18 Rabbit, and on the adjoining side is this simian creature, which has this smoking glyph coming out of the top of the head, which, again, paralleling to Mesoamerican culture, that represents smoke monkey. Now, the monkey and the rabbit, not only were they intimately connected in Mesoamerican lordships, you had 18 rabbit and you had his predecessor was smoke monkey. So the parallels there were pretty startling. And not only that, even in the Mesoamerican culture, the scribes, you had the rabbit scribe and the monkey scribe. So the parallels there are pretty interesting.
Bill, as a geomorphologist, which is a guy that deals with landforms, shapes, erosion processes, the geology of how mountains are formed and how they slough away, what are the odds that these glyphs, these intelligent-looking designs, could just be total chance, that you guys are incredibly imaginative projectionists, but you're not really looking at anything real down there?
Well, we think that just by the volume that we have, as I stated earlier, we have over two dozen examples in our book.
Over how much area?
On
Mars.
Basically, we've just looked at the immediate Cydonia area that you described as the city, and a few other mesas like the face and a couple surrounding the face, but just in that small area. And I'm not exactly sure what the extent is, maybe 10 miles by 10
miles. It's about the size of the Bay Area in San Francisco.
Okay.
Right. So every single structure that we've looked at we've found something that we can connect to Earth. So the odds of that, I think, even finding two or three is pretty astronomical, and we're over two dozen.
Do you have any idea of the odds?
No, I don't think that you could calculate the odds. But just looking at the face itself, people think that, well, it's eroded. Well, where did the erosional material go? Because it's certainly not in the surrounding area around the mesa. And I noted early on, right in April of 1998, when they first started releasing the Cydonia images, that there was all kinds of examples where you could say, okay, well, this could be volcanic, and this over here could be a glacier, formed by a glacier. But the problem being that one would have to annihilate the other. If you had glaciation, it would eradicate the things that were formed by volcanoes.
Yeah, this is similar to Errol Torren's argument. You know, he was a geomorphologist with the Defense Mapping Agency many years ago when he came to our work, and he said that for the DNM, which you have not discussed, and I can understand why, but he said the formation processes that he saw would have precluded natural forces, natural geomorphological forces from shaping it, because if it shaped one side, it would eliminate the symmetry on the other side and vice versa.
That's right. And I know that Dr. Carlotto has kind of steadfastly clung to the idea that the what we call the feline side of the face is actually was symmetrical, and the feline side has actually just been eroded. But of course we present in our findings that that's not the case. Plus we have found other images that are on that same side on other structures, I guess it would be the northeast side, that would be covered or eradicated if there was erosion, but they're very pristine.
Now, in terms of this pristineness, I mean, we've all been thinking, those of us that have been at this a while, we're looking at stuff that's very old, that's ancient. I know Vince, you know, claims a billion years. That's based on NASA's models for atmosphere, you know, pressure and density and that kind of thing. I think they're perhaps much younger, maybe 500,000, 300,000 is the date that I get. And I got that by the alignment, you know, with the solstice sunrise model that we have in monuments. What would be your estimate, best guesstimate, as to the age of the things that we're looking at down there?
Well, I would say that they were built in the last 10,000 years.
Ooh.
But that's only because of the symbolism of the earthly cultures. Because we're finding
okay.
Symbolism with the Maya, the
now,
Egyptian.
Hold it. This is fascinating, because if that's a ballpark estimate, 10,000, 13,000, whatever, that puts us in the vicinity of Plato's Atlantis, right?
Right.
Which is supposedly, according to some mythos, a high-tech civilization, not just, you know, Bronze Age culture. Is it possible that we could be looking at a reverse osmosis here? In other words, we're looking at our guys, us guys, that went to Mars in the last 10,000 years, did this stuff, came home, you know, devolved because of some cataclysm. We're now going back and finding what our own guys did, not from the Mars side, but from the Earth side. What do you think?
That could possibly be an explanation for this, because of the fact that we're finding all these cross-cultural symbolisms in a lot of these different structures, which, like Bill was saying, we couldn't understand how these things could be there if they were supposed to be so ancient, because, you know, we can just about designate how old human culture is.
Well,
and,
see, this feeds
now.
You
know, a lot of early researchers were dating this stuff way before any man was around.
Did you get a chance to read Graham Hancock's book on Mars?
Yes, when it first came out.
Okay. Remember a date he had in there that when I read it, I thought, no, he's not right. Based on your work, I'm wondering if maybe Graham had a cute little inside source out of JPL, because...
Well, what was he thinking? What was it, 10,500
years? 20,000 years!
Right.
Which, you know, I mean, if everybody understands in the audience, for a geomorphologist, there's no difference between 10 and 20,000 years, right?
Right, pretty much.
So, I mean, the geology works so slowly that if it's 10,000 or 20,000, it's the same 1,000.
By the way, everyone, this is what you get when you watch Richard in action at a conference. It's really something. Go ahead, Richard.
Thanks, George. The dating is really cool, because if it's that recent, then it makes the scenario that when I did monuments, I laid out three possible scenarios, okay? One was that we had an Earth civilization, high tech, that went to Mars, left this stuff, came home, collapsed, and we're basically picking up the pieces, okay? Number two, that we had a Martian civilization that arose somehow on a planet which back then we didn't have the geology down that we now have from the Spirit and Opportunity rovers. We didn't have people like George Shultz, Sir George, you know, finding fossils. you know, after I found a few, he's found a whole bunch more. So the idea of an indigenous Martian civilization is kind of coming up fast on the inside track. And model number three was that we had somebody came from the stars from way outside the solar system. They found this little place. They decided that they would habitate on Mars because they couldn't come to Earth because it was a radically different planet. And then ultimately they had to do something with us guys here, you know, Homo erectus and all that, genetically tinker a successive species, a kind of heir apparent that would carry on their work because they could never come here themselves. Well, what you guys are finding seems to be pushing us in the direction of model number one.
Right.
What do you think?
The data set doesn't support the others.
No. It says more recent. It says Earth to Mars. It says absolutely identical iconography. I can't get over the bat comparison in the city square. And what you found in the Olmec iconography, it's guys, you got to see this book. You got to go out and buy this book. If for no other reason, it's going to blow your mind. The point by point by point specific comparisons are phenomenal. And William, you are very smart not to try to put odds on this because they're off the edge of the paper. There are trillions to one that this can be accidental.
It's about this point, Richard, where hundreds of people are trying to get into the conference room to hear you, and there's not enough seats left. Do you remember that?
I remember vividly, yes. Yes.
Richard, for this to be arbitrary, it would, you know, to do a cultural comparison, it would be like finding structures on Mars that look like the characters from the Simpsons TV show.
Exactly.
And finding all of the different characters, and you finding Marge next to what's her husband's name?
Homer.
I don't remember.
Homer.
Homer.
Homer. Yes, of course.
I got to start watching TV, I guess. But it would be like finding the entire cast of The Simpsons on these structures on Mars. It's just incalculable.
Well, the night that Art and Kinsey and I did what I call the Art Show. Not a pun on Bell, but basically that we passed beyond the Israel or Memorex. And I talked about your work, George. Remember that night?
Yes.
And I said, this is going to be something you got to watch. I had no idea that you guys would find the specifics. I mean, if anybody out there is a fan of CSI, you know, these guys have nailed the crime, the victim, the culprit, the bullet holes, the fingerprints. I mean, they have done it. They have proven that there is a terrestrial connection, and it's just dawning on me as we talk tonight that you may have gotten the time frame down that matches what Graham Hancock from his deep sources in JPL was hinting at in his new Mars book.
Well, you note, Richard, in the book that Linda Shelley was invited, one of the leading archaeologists that happened to die a month after the original 1998 image of the face came out. She was invited to speak before NASA about the cosmological connections between the Maya and the cosmos.
Richard, yes. Very quick for you, by the
yes.
way,
yes.
because they did not get into the pyramids. You have looked at those structures. Those things alone are very, very peculiar, are they not?
Well, they're huge. What I saw back in 87, and I think even more so tonight, they're huge living spaces. You know, we're not looking at basically sand paintings. We're looking at people who lived in a place, and they left the clues as to who they were, what they were, which is us, when they went there, if William is correct, and we've got to go back. And the travesty is we have a space agency, NASA, that we pay for, and they will do anything but go to Cydonia and simply resolve this.
Well, and I don't know why they won't unless they've already done it.
And they don't want us to know. It's very simple.
Exactly.
It's not a mystery. They don't want us to know.
Richard, we're going to take phone calls next hour. You're more than welcome to hang around if you want. It's your choice.
I think I'm going to go away and listen.
Okay.
These guys deserve their moment in the sun, which is going to become a week and then a month and then a year.
And we've been working you like crazy lately, haven't we?
Yes, you have.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Guys, good luck, and you've done sterling work. And everybody out there, buy this book. Your life will never be the same.
Richard C. Hoagland, definitely an expert on the Cydonia region. It was good to hear him and his comments and questions, by the way. We'll be back in a moment. We'll open up the phone lines with our two guests, George Haas and William Saunders, and you on There's a picture in your book, George and William, of what you call the Martian tiger, the water lily jaguar. And also, you know, if you look at it in a different perspective, you know, to each his eye, right? To me, it looks like an angel with its wings spread out. On 6.14B, do you see that picture?
I'm just finding it.
Okay.
I know which one you're
talking about, the water lily jaguar?
Yes. Also called the Martian tiger. 6.14B. It's on page 136 of your book. I mean, that could, to some people who have a different perspective, looks like an angel with its wings out, doesn't it?
Well, I'm so used to looking at it as a tiger, I have a hard time seeing anything else. So.
All right, I'm going to... Nobody in our listening audience to that extent has your book, and we don't have that image, so I guess I can't pull my...
All listeners, please go to page 136.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice, huh?
But what you're saying, George, is something that George and I ran across when we first started to look at these structures, is that we were at times seeing different things, and we were, you know, each of us being certain that we were seeing something different, and... that's the nature of these structures, because there are images within images, and some of them overlap different angles, and so it's hard to, you know, sometimes hard to determine exactly what is supposed to be represented.
How did you agree on certain images? How did that happen?
Well, basically, it was very often that we saw the same thing. But there were the times when Bill would send me something. Most, which comes to mind at this point, was when he sent me the image of the infant baby child.
Yes.
I could not see that at all for weeks. I kept looking at it, and he had to actually do an awkward drawing to show me exactly what he was looking at. And then I just about fell out of the chair when I saw what
he was saying. It's a little like me looking at this tiger, and I see an angel.
Right, well, this is a traditional... exercise that has been done with other images such as this, and it is legitimate for the creator to guide the viewer to show them what they're supposed to be looking for.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going, first of all, to West of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening.
Yeah, hi.
I have a question about the image and relative to Bigfoot also. I'm a semi-retired physician and an explorer, and I encountered, when I first went to Honduras in 74, Ciudad del Blanco, the original first capital of the Mayan Empire, which was abandoned long before the 900s. It was about 846. And they went up from there into Santa Rosa Copan and made that their capital. Now, in Ciudad del Blanco, we have ancient tombs, four huge sarcophagi, and a lot of stela and huge artifacts and many things. My associate, Dr. Ramiro Gonzalez, when he was a young man, amassed a large amount of this treasure with his father, Generalissimo Ramon Gonzalez, and they hid it in a cave. And they found... in with this collection, a lot of artifacts which seem to be extraterrestrial in origin and in manifest. They also found statues to substantiate their belief, their family belief, in Sisimiti, which is the Spanish word in Honduras for Bigfoot. And they have an Iganti, which is 9 foot. Apparently there are polymorphic forms of them. And then they have the Ulaks. In the Miskito language, they call them Ulawas. I own the Ulawas Valley with Dr. Ramon Gonzalez and his family there. It's kind of a joint venture. It's a huge valley with gold and a lot of other treasures there. Anyhow, we have the Denuncio on it, and it's 3 days' forced march journey from Catacamas in Olancho, the biggest state of Honduras. Now, there we found... all these artifacts, we see them very clearly in the public plaza in Santa Rosa Copan, where the spaceman is seated and the fire is coming down underneath him. And the same motif is found again in Tikal in Guatemala. And also in Belize, I have some business interests, and I've explored there and have found that same motif on Stella there. My question is...
Excuse me, are you talking about the falling god?
Yes, the falling god.
Right, okay.
Okay, and my question is there a relationship between this space being, either human going up or coming down, as well as the Sisimiti? Because the bones have been found. We have a cave there that's legendary in this one village called La Bodega off the Patuca River, and this is where the bones are reposed in a cave. There's only a few people that know about it. I'm one of them, and I intend to go back there and get those bones. At any rate, there are numerous hundreds of villages up and down the Patuca and Wyambri and Juticalpa rivers where the natives have sighted CPCPs. This is the Littlefoot. They're about 28 inches tall. One was captured near Santa Rosa Copan, and my associate, Don Thomas Corbello Holmes, which spoke eight languages before he died at age of 92, he was calling for me. I was still back in the States, and I got the message 2 weeks late. They found a CPCP. It was wrapped up in barbed wire and witnessed by the chief of police, the military commandant there for Santa Rosa Copan, and the leading citizens. And they say, oh, mono feo, sucio, botolo. So they threw it over the city wall, and it smelled. It had a foul odor to it. And it was eaten by dogs in the night. And someone said, well, let's get a hold of Don Thomas. And they did, but it was evidence gone. But there are many people that could swear to the affidavits of that specimen. And it had a humanoid face, humanoid hands, very hairy, but just a little foot. They're called CPCPs. They're found in that province.
Are they all over the place out there?
They're all over that one region of Honduras that borders the El Salvador border and up into the Guatemala border.
Huh.
And they travel in large troops. They're gregarious. They're not like the Bigfoot or the Sisimiti. Also, Dr. Gonzalez, when he was a young man, I think he was about to go to medical school, his father... brought back a girl from the mountains from another really remote village beyond La Concepcion in Olancho. And the woman was taken off by one of the Ulaks, one of the big guys, and had a baby with him. And the baby was brought back over a year later. She escaped. She brought the baby with her, but she was hysterical and deranged, and she was treated by the local people. She eventually regained her sanity, but the baby died for lack of care. And this is a well-documented incident there in Catacamas.
Well, gentlemen, any reaction to this?
I'm not sure what to make of it. I know that the Bigfoot legend of the Indians is spread out through the Americas and also in Asia and far east, and also in Russia. This is the first I've heard of the little feet.
Yeah, that was pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who knows what those things might be?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for that call. And it does tell you one thing. On this planet, on Mars, there are still some very strange, unexplained things. And I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of these things. First time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good evening, Jerry.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I've been trying to get through with this one for a couple of years now. There's an artifact on Mars that everyone seems to have missed. And the last time I was on Enterprise mission, the pics are still there down towards the bottom somewhere.
Okay.
But you remember a couple of years ago when Richard presented us with a pair of pictures as proof that those, shall we say, Nimrods of Nemesis over at NASA were trying to hide things from us?
Yes.
Well, you can look at those and tilt your head to the left, or you can simply rotate the pictures so that the right side is down.
Okay.
And in the new bottom center area, you'll see what I begin to think of as old Baldy. Looks for all the world like a bald guy with big eyes to handle the dimmer light and a beard. A much, much more human-looking face on Mars.
You've got some human-looking faces in the book, gentlemen, George and William, don't you?
The Viking looks very human.
You've also got a Buddha picture in there.
That's right, yes.
He looks very
human. That's on the front cover, actually. just in the bottom right-hand corner.
Right, but many of them are very zoomorphic.
If you showed these pictures to 100 people, would you get 40 different things and 20 different things? What do you think the number would be?
Well, from our experience with doing a few conventions and talking with people, most people that are looking at the book can see the images readily. We really haven't experienced anyone.
Are they the same images, though?
Cross-eyed and going, you know, what are you looking
at? I mean, do they see similar images or do they see other images? Like, again, you see tigers, I see an angel.
Right. We've never had that response. That's pretty drastic.
Yeah, it is. But I wish I could show this right now and just get a quick poll to that.
Right.
But we cannot. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. George,
yes.
William. My name is Carrie. I'm calling from Western North Carolina.
Hi,
and
Carrie.
I want to throw out a quick hypothesis to all of you and to Mr. Hoagland, too, if he is listening. To me, this kind of ties in with a lot of topics you've talked about on the show, the lost city of Atlantis. You had brought up the possibility that perhaps the Atlanteans had come from Mars. I think that's a possibility that maybe their planet was dying and that they had come here. They had the advanced technology. It also ties in with the weather manipulation. Maybe they had some sort of advanced technology to where they could take that a step farther, kind of like the Star Trek movie where they had the Genesis probe and they shot it into the planet and it became a living planet. It just seems to tie into so many things. And as to the question of why would the government not want us to know about this, I think it is because it would challenge our fundamental religious beliefs and it would throw basically everything in the Bible out the window. And I think that is the main reason a lot of these things are kept secret. And I'm going to get off so that I can hear your response. But I just want to know what you think of that idea and those possibilities.
All right, why are these things kept secret, William, George?
Well, it's possible that there could be a number of reasons. But as Richard Hoagland has pointed out in the past, that back in the 1950s, President Eisenhower brought together a group. Brookings Institute to try to determine, what would be their action if they were to find extraterrestrial artifacts in space or on another planet, since they were going to begin venturing out in the 1950s and 60s into space. And the panel, which included Margaret Mead, decided that it would be best kept secret from the general population because they thought that this might that our psyche was so fragile that our society couldn't handle this information and our society would crumble, which to me is a little insane, but that's what the Brookings Institute decided, and possibly they're sticking to that.
See, I don't think society would crumble, but I do think society would become a little more unruly than it might already be, and I think that's their main concern. I don't think they can control the masses if we truly believed and understood about the possibilities of life elsewhere. I think,
well, George,
go ahead.
I don't think it's our culture that the government was worried about. It was probably other cultures and other fanatical religious-based groups that were the danger. I think the United States public is probably more open to researching this kind of thing than other groups.
All right, let's go back to some more calls.
George, just one more thing.
Sure.
The lady was asking about the possibility that Mars had a civilization.
Yes.
That their planet died. The word Nephilim in the Bible was referring to another culture or another race. And one definition of that word is giants. And I don't know if that's correct or not, but it's used quite often by religious scholars. Now, if a race developed on Mars, they would have to be larger just because of the gravity and whatnot. They would probably be much larger than us. And so that is, I guess, a possibility.
East of the Rockies, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Albert from Cleveland. How are you doing?
Good, Albert. Thank you.
Good. I have a question for your guest and you. I'm just curious. I'm wondering if you guys heard of the Bible verse, chapter 1, Ezekiel. Often the Bible talks about the discs and the angels.
Sure. I have. I'm sure you two have as well.
Yeah,
sure.
And then Elijah and the whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering your opinion on that, if we thought it was angels or aliens. And then I want to know both your opinions on whether you believe that world religion came from extraterrestrials in contrast to the religion and teachings of Jesus Christ in the Holy Bible, and I'll listen on the phone.
Okay, very good. In terms of Ezekiel, I have always believed that what people witnessed was a flying machine of some sort. Well, I can't say it was alien, but I do believe it was a flying machine. How about you, George?
The description in the Bible is pretty convincing that it's some type of machine. That would just, my uneducated opinion,
sure,
just by what I'm reading.
William?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that back in those days, there were no machines. So when a person was confronted with something like that, they would have to describe it in the only means that they knew how. And a burning bush and those sorts of things would probably fit.
Do you think some of the things we're talking about tonight, things on Mars, had any effect at all with our religion on this planet today?
Well, I think that my opinions are based a lot on from what I've read of Zachariah Sitchin's work, and to me it seems to fit quite well with what we've been finding on Mars, and the fact that the term gods, the term Elohim,
mm-hmm,
in the Bible actually is a plural word and means deities. And over the course of time, that somehow got translated into a single deity. But I think that the religion of the Hebrews developed out of Egypt when they left Egypt. They sort of designed their own theology, and that's how their religion evolved. And, of course, Christianity and Islam developed from that.
All right, when we come back, we'll take final phone calls and ask the question, of course, that was just asked, if extraterrestrials were the gods. We've got final phone calls with our guest, George Haas, William Saunders, the book, The Cydonia Codex. George, William, if you had a chance to go to a NASA news conference and talk to Mike Griffin, the new NASA head, what would you tell him? What would you ask him? You, William, you go first.
Well, I would, I would say take a look at what we found and what are your thoughts? I would also ask him why they never did any intensive or even some research onto the face after the 1998 Mars Global Surveyor image, which definitely showed that there was something artificial about that structure. Why they just ignored it and stuck to their guns that it was just a pile of rocks.
How about you, George?
Well, my question would be, why did they invite Linda Shelley to speak before NASA? And what exactly did she tell them behind closed doors? Because it appears that NASA knows probably more than Bill and I do.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. I think, wouldn't you love to be a little fly on a wall in one of those rooms?
Or a little gnat.
A little gnat with a little camera on you. Let's go back to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm calling from Denver. My name's Marianne, and I'm going to tie this all up for you guys.
Oh, I hope so.
So exciting.
Sure.
Super.
Unlike that lady who thought it would destroy everyone's beliefs, in fact, and the Bible has the whole answer to it, chapter 12 of Revelations, In the Old Testament, the Jews were told, the Jews told all the other pagan religions that their God said to them, you will be my people and I will be your God. And then in the New Testament, Jesus dies as the final blood sacrifice, the lamb suffered for all of mankind. And then in the 1500s, a great sign appeared in Tepeyac on the hill. A lady clothed with the sun and standing on the moon and flying on eagle's wings appeared to a Mayan Indian who had been converted by the Catholic monks. And she left this sign on his cloak, and she converted 9 million of those Indians who understood that what they were looking at was an Indian princess standing in front of Quetzalcoatl, and she is pregnant, looking down in humble submission to her stomach where her baby is. The Savior had been prophesied would come to the Mayans, and they knew that was the end of their religion. And her dress shows the topographic map of Mexico, and she's the mother of God, and it's all right there, and it's fascinating.
Who wants that? All right, let's see if one of the two want to react to that.
Okay, I'll just go ahead and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Who wants it? George, William?
Well, that could relate to the image that we were looking at earlier with the inverted face on Mars. The figure at the bottom is the Lady of the Jade Skirt. Not only do all of these pictographic images in the inverted face image relate to Egyptian mythology, in the book we also discuss the parallels between each of these symbols and what they represent, basically the same idea in Mesoamerica. But that tri-leaf symbol on the forehead, when that's inverted, it makes up the skirt. That's the Lady of the Jade Skirt. And that's the woman that she's basically talking about that's mentioned in the Revelation story.
Well, you know what? There is no way all of these things could be just natural. Some of them maybe. And you look at it and you go, hey, that's interesting. But not as many as you have pointed out tonight. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, my name is Chuck. I'm calling from Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C.
Sure, Chuck. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I remember watching years ago the show In Search Of with the host Leonard Nimoy, and they showed a outer space rock with a cross-section cut and embedded in that rock in space with an alien type of...
I think I lost you. Yeah, we did. Faded out right at the end. I do not know the direction he was going to take that, guys. So,
well, I think he's talking about that famous, they thought it was a meteorite or a rock, and it seemed to have this remnant of what looked to be an ancient mechanical generator or something in the stone. I recalled seeing that program.
Did that make you marvel?
At the time, I guess that was in the late 70s when that program was on.
International Line, where are you calling from? Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, where are you?
Ontario.
Okay, go ahead.
It's more or less my theory. You know how we were saying we want to get to Mars? Like, people want to land once again on there? What if we were once already there and our God was, say, aliens, and we were just a science project? And we messed up, piling it up, and they sent what was left of us here to Earth. And now that's why those figures and things are there.
A science project went awry, no doubt, huh?
Yeah, like we were, like say, like an ant farm. They gave us God, say, like an ant farm has a queen, something for us to follow. But we didn't make it there. We destroyed that planet, and they put it, we came to Earth now, and we're doing the same to this.
Well, that's a possibility. Possibility indeed.
Because it's dead. Well, the planet looks dead. And it's pretty much what's on Mars is kind of like what's Egypt.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Do you gentlemen both think the planet is dead at this point?
Well, I don't think it's completely dead. I think that there is signs that there could be even algae or lichen growth at during this springtime when the ice caps melt. They are getting methane signatures over that area, which indicates there could be life, but there also could be life underground. I mean, the people who built these structures, there could still be people there on Mars living underground because it would be warm and there would be liquid water underground, and that's always a possibility. As far as the his theory of us being a science project, it reminds me of a fellow at the X conference, and his name slips my mind at the moment, but he said in regards to why don't the aliens come down and reveal themselves, he said, because we're the best soap opera going.
You may be right about that. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. Hello there.
Hi.
Yeah, and where are you?
This is Ryan Schaefer in Los Angeles.
Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi. I have the idea that the face seems like a little more like you were saying, like a cloud formation that could be interpreted in many ways. But the pyramids in the region seem more measurable with the straight edges and whatnot. And that maybe we were just subconsciously attracted to that area and the face stuck out. And then a second question they can or cannot answer is if they have any comment on the crop circle that happened a few years ago in England that seems to mimic the face on Mars.
All right, gentlemen, crop circles and the face.
I don't know much about crop circles. I've seen a lot of the images on Linda Moulton Howe's website.
Right.
I guess he's talking about the image that looked like a face that was woven into the wheat.
It looked like a little alien face.
Right. Some of the geometric patterns that's produced in this wheat are phenomenal, but I don't have a clue if they're, you know, made by, you know, guys out in the woods with planks and ropes, or they're made by aliens.
All right, a few more phone calls, and that'll be just about it for tonight. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. That was too quick. You got me just as soon as I got through talking.
Surprise. Well, I hit the wrong line. Let me put you back on hold. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
This is Mike. I'm calling from Nashville. And, you know, every time I listen to the show and this subject is brought up a lot with Hoagland and everything, I can't ever help but just to recall that, you know, Michio Kaku talks about the different classifications of civilizations, 0, 1, 2, and 3.
Three.
Where, you know, 0, you use things of your own planet, and 1, you know, of your sun, and 2 of your solar system, 3 of your, or 2 of your galaxy, and 3 of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's how you advance. And, he always put a caveat in there that very few people get from 0 to 1. Which Earth is still in the process of 0 to 1 right now. I mean, we've done the atom, but we haven't really, you know, utilized the power of the sun and the wind and all of the natural things that are here for us to the extent that it's economical for us. And we're talking about again maybe going back to the nukes and with the reactors and everything, and then God only knows what would go for that. We're totally depleting our you know, our fossil fuels and all that. You know, I'm kind of like a lot of people. I think we're at an end point on that. I know you don't, George. I know your theory on that, but
Mr. Optimist here.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with being an optimist. You know, we need more of them too. But I just wonder if you know, possibly like you know, you take Mars and many other worlds out there where possibly some of the species from, say, a class 2 of civilization or a class 3 maybe was trying to teach something, you know, and take care of the planet and all that, and Mars didn't achieve that. And so, you know, here comes Earth that still has an atmosphere. Another thing, you know, we notice a lot of the things that we find here on Earth are above the tree line at 14,000 feet or
so.
I often wonder if that is, you know, maybe because they need the thinner atmosphere. I don't know whether gravity is any less at that height. I wouldn't think it would be. But there are a lot of petroglyphs and you know, with the thing on the plains of Nazca down there in Venezuela.
Yes.
There's been so many things in the high mountains that have been discovered that seem to be of the hieroglyphics and everything that are now being discovered maybe on other worlds and all. And
Machu Picchu's on top of a mountain.
Yeah, right. And of course, underground is one thing, but maybe way above there where, you know, there are unexplored mountains just as much as there's unexplored seas and under the earth, and especially in the Amazon and deepest, darkest Africa and South America and all, in the Azores.
Do you think we have underground civilizations here, Mike, on this planet?
I think possibly if they were here, that would be the place to be. If you notice, a lot of us now, when we're thinking of all of this disasters coming along with terrorism and all that, there's people actually buying old missile silos and all of that. You go to a cave, George, and you know we're thinking about going underground. And you know, you do have at least a pristine environment down there.
Well, you don't know. You haven't seen my cave.
You're where the Budweiser used to store their old.
Yeah, that's where I'm holed out, right?
Before
in St. Louis.
Refrigeration. But you know, I think that if nothing else that we gather from this, we get the message that maybe let's start saving our planet and doing like the Indians used to do, and you know, use what we need but put back what we didn't use and quit wasting so much. I think that's the cardinal sin for the planet as a race on this mud ball.
What do you guys think about all this?
Well, it's not thoughtful to waste our resources.
Not
I don't know if it has anything to do with the structures that we're finding on Mars.
There could be some similarities, though, I think. Do you think that there are inhabitants still on Mars? Maybe they're underground?
Yeah,
I don't think so, because I really don't see any evidence of any movement on the planet or any ongoing construction or building.
On top.
Right.
But maybe deep within.
But then we'd have no...
Maybe they had to do that somehow.
Right, but we'd have no way of knowing.
No, that's true. What about you, George?
I'm George.
Oh, what about you, William?
Well, I think it's a possibility. We're taking still photographs, so you wouldn't necessarily see any movement. But there is evidence that of trails and pathways or roadways a bit archaic, but leading to some of these structures. So it is possible that there could be remnants of civilization living underground. But I don't think we'll know that until we go there.
Well, I hope that's sooner than later. What do you think, 20 years?
I don't think we're going to go there in our lifetime the way the space program.
It's unfortunate. I think we could, technologically, if we put our act together.
Well, George, could you imagine in the early 1600s if they approached, you know, coming to the New World the way NASA approaches, you know, the space shuttle?
They'd never get to the New World.
Now, as soon as they, you know, they lost a few people in a boat that sunk, you know, they would stop building ships. It's like if we want to go to space, you know, we have to be prepared to make sacrifices. I mean, if we want to go there, I don't think that Columbus would have ever made it across the water the way NASA's running their research program.
Okay, for you, William, one wish you can get it done with regards to anything in the space program or what you've been working on. One wish, what would it be?
I really don't know. I really don't know. I guess
you're going to give up that one wish.
I'd have to think about it. I think, but I definitely would like color photographs of Cydonia.
How about you, George?
That's what I would go for, to see what these structures are made out of, because I have some theories that the face on Mars, the humanoid side, is a totally different material than the feline side. The whole surface appears to me in the newer 2001 image to be very compartmentalized, like pieces of jade on the feline side, whereas the humanoid side is very reflective, like a metallic type of material.
Would you two go to Mars if you could get back safely, you think, if you had that kind of confidence?
Oh, yeah.
I told my wife I'll leave tomorrow.
You would. I would go, too. I would broadcast the whole trip.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Of course, we'd have to broadcast about Mars for the whole trip, but
we'd probably have to bring Richard Hoagland with us.
In that case, I'm not sure I'd want to go. No, I'm kidding. Only kidding, Richard. Only kidding. Hey, the book is called The Cydonia Codex. Available where now?
Wherever books are sold.
Well, that's
it's available
a lot of spots.
Through our publisher at NorthAtlanticBooks.com. If you want to send in $18.95 for a signed copy of the book, you can send it to the Cydonia Institute at P.O. Box 1032, Jackson, New Jersey. Zip code is 08527. The book's also available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble.
Very good. Gentlemen, George, William, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having us, George.
Thanks Likewise. For inviting us, George.
Absolutely. Good research, by the way, into the Cydonia Codex. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.